then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, O O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man the chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 19th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Okay, one more kind of housekeeping type note. Beginning in a couple of days, we're going to have a whole raft of visitors arriving here in the Pugetopolis for their scouting trips, including two families who are coming in for a second look. I guess everybody this year decided to do their scouting trips in late July, which is good, definitely better than late January. Anyway, I'm looking forward to meeting them all. Once again, as is so often the case, I have to preface this with, don't get me wrong. Now, I want to meet as many of you as I possibly can. It's vitally important that I do. But you need to have some idea of what to expect when you get here. Now, I admit, I have a tendency to disappoint people when we meet in person. I'm never quite sure exactly what the folks expect, but whatever it is, I'm usually not it. Now, first off, you guys do understand, don't you, that there is no compound, that there are no guys in camouflage fatigues guarding some rural retreat with illegal, fully automatic weapons, right? That's just the movies and the television. Most of the so-called compounds we've had in the past are basically just some guy's house in the woods and a couple of acres of land attached to it. Even Pastor Butler's place was only about 20 acres. There's no big Northwest Front headquarters office building with flags out. I wish there was. One of these days, I hope we'll have enough money to rent one. We'll have to rent it because, due to the abuse of civil litigation to do an end run around the First Amendment by people like Morris Dease, and more recently due to federal asset seizure laws which allow the regime to steal people's property for spitting on the sidewalk, neither we nor anyone in the white nationalist movement will ever be able to own anything of value again. Now, that's another little sobering fact that tends to frighten people off from the Northwest. Even if someone is brave enough to stand up to individual enemies or the law, you threaten a white boy's precious job or his money or his property, and he'll fold like a lawn chair. Another thing is, I think people who visit me here tend to find me boring, because to their astonishment, I don't have anything to say that they haven't already read in my novels or heard me say right here on Radio Free Northwest. And it's true. With me, what you see is what you get. That's why it always puzzles me that the FBI is spending so much time watching me and monitoring my emails and listening to this podcast and sending strange people around to sit on my sofa and try and get me to talk about illegal things. Because there's no mystery here, guys. Yes, I think this country sucks. And I think we need to change the whole thing from top to bottom. Starting with getting rid of people like you. For this, you have to spend tens of thousands of dollars of the taxpayers' money monitoring me? I'll tell you that for free. And if you don't believe me, you can read my books. Order them from Amazon. They'll tell you all you need to know about me, and they'll cost a hell of a lot less than whatever you're doing now. There is no inner esoteric cult of the NF or anything like that. I have no secret knowledge, no secret plans that I can only whisper in your ear personally, nothing like that. You have spent months or maybe years listening to me tell you to pack the moving van and get your ass up here. And some people are actually surprised when we finally meet in person and the first thing I say is, "So, when are you going to pack the moving van and get your ass up here?" I'm not saying don't come and visit, guys. Please do. Any kind of activity that doesn't involve a computer terminal is good. Just don't expect to be Indiana Jones finding the Ark of the Covenant. All you're going to find here is the last worthwhile place to live in North America. Got an interesting email a few days ago from Lee in Ohio, whom I don't know, and for all I know, this may actually be a heckle, but it goes, "Dear HAC, if this is such a terrible tyranny and such an awful police state, why haven't you been arrested yet? Why are you still talking on the internet?" Well, the answer to that is I don't really know, Lee. Same reason I don't really know why I have escaped Morris Dees and Frank Potok's leprous attentions for the past 6 years. It used to be a badge of honor to be smeared by Dees in his rag, but it's an honor I haven't had for some time now. I think old Morris and his catamite Frank don't quite know what to make of me. What motivates the minds of our lords and masters has always been something of a mystery. For starters, I don't actually break any laws, which helps, although it's not the deciding factor, of course. Whenever the decision is made at a sufficiently elevated level in the corridors of power to remove someone that the faceless people in the silk suits find inconvenient or annoying, they will fabricate evidence and perjure themselves blind on the witness stand without hesitation. They have no sense of morality and not the slightest whiff of basic human decency in them. These concepts simply are not part of the inner makeup of anyone who serves the United States in any capacity. The latest and most notorious example of this is the Edgar Steele case, of course, but I first ran into it back in the early 70s in the case of a man in North Carolina whom nobody remembers anymore. His name was Leroy Gibson, and it's a pity that nobody remembers him anymore because Leroy was good folks, the kind of man we used to get back in those days, a retired Marine gunnery sergeant who led from the front, ran his group with military discipline, and never heard of the internet. So, why did they take Edgar Steele and not me? Again, to be honest, I just don't know. Maybe my turn's coming and they'll kick in my door tomorrow morning at dawn. Who knows? I'll tell you what really helps our people live the kind of lives we have to lead. Read Alexander Solzhenitsyn's The Gulag Archipelago about life under Stalin. I'm rereading it now, in fact. I know there is no such thing as exact historical parallels, although in larger patterns history does tend to repeat itself. Now, Stalin and his goons would simply drag you away into the night, torture a confession out of you, and then either shoot you through the head or send you to the gold mines in Kolyma. Very basic, nothing subtle at all there. Stalin's tyranny reveled in its own inhumanity, but I will say this about Obama's tyranny. While it's true that they've started arresting people for posting poems on the internet in the true Stalin style, and it's true that people are now getting visits from the Secret Service for blogs or for the crime of having anti-Obama bumper stickers on their cars or a Republican campaign sign in their yard, the American tyranny does tend to be somewhat more subtle and nuanced and not yet quite as widespread, although once they get all those CCTV cameras installed like they've got in Britain, most American cities at least will be right there in 1984. The FBI does inspire the same kind of widespread fear and loathing among the people that the NKVD used to do in the Soviet Union. One aspect of all this, of course, has to do with the mindset of the secret police. I honestly think that the people in the FBI and BATFE and Homeland Security and NSA and the whole alphabet soup of political coercion are much more divorced from reality than Stalin's old gangsters and the blue tabs were. By that, I don't mean that they're unaware of what they are or what they're doing or the moral implications of what they're doing. They are. The United States government pays them money and full medical and dental coverage to hurt people, to force Americans of my skin color and heritage into obedience and cooperation in our own destruction, to deny us our freedom to speak and think and believe as we choose. Now, no matter how they rationalize it, federal agents know full well that that's the deal they've made with the powers of darkness, and most of them are good with it. I don't think it would be possible to work more than a year or two as an FBI agent before even the dumbest buzz-cut red, white, and blue Pat Robertson neoconservative realizes on some level of consciousness that he's one of the guys in the black hats. But I think most of these people live in their own little cocoon of alternate reality of the kind always created by large and powerful institutions. what the yuppies refer to as the corporate culture. And I think they get so wrapped up in their own bizarro world that 2 + 2 = 5 within that world. Up is down and black is white. Now, getting back to your question, Lee, as to why I'm not sitting in the next cell to Edgar Steele right now, again, I just don't know, but I think it has something to do with the weird goings-on in that FBI corporate culture I mentioned. The big offices and cubicles and conference rooms here, there, and everywhere with all the little factions and intrigues and personal empires being built and torn down, wheels turning within wheels, so forth and so on. Now, maybe some of them just like listening to these podcasts. Last time I got visited, one of them told me he liked the music. My personal theory is that for whatever reason, someone in the Justice Department or elsewhere has decided that this regime is not quite ready just yet to begin arresting and persecuting writers, or possibly internet broadcasters. Hal Turner doesn't count. He was one of theirs, an FBI informer who got out of control just like J.T. Reddy. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to poets, apparently. Ask Johnny Logan Spencer. I don't want to spend this whole podcast ranting and raving on this topic, but I think this may explain the psychology of it. We in the English-speaking world inherited a lot from good old Queen Victoria. Among it all, a deep-seated need to keep up appearances and to maintain the great lie that all in the real world is as it should be and that everybody obeys all the rules and there is this nice, sane, stable order in the world presided over by benevolent genies with federal badges. This is one reason we see all these damn TV shows making heroes out of these scum. The FBI stopped obeying its own laws and rules a long time ago, but there is a limit to how far they will admit in public that they disregard their own rules. So far, they keep pushing the envelope. I've thought a lot about why they did what they did to Edgar Steele. Of course, it may simply be that Ed really, really pissed off somebody in power. Ed told me once that the whole legal system hated him because he had defended Richard Butler and the Christines, and he was considered a traitor to his class. Well, maybe that's it. But my present theory is that the Edgar Steele case was an experiment on the part of the FBI to see how far they could go, to see if they could get away with actual fabrication of evidence from the ground up, including bogus technology like the doctored audio tapes. I say tapes out of force of old habit. Actually, I think they're digital audio files like this podcast is. Anyway, I think in the Edgar Steele case, they're sending a message to the rest of us. We can and will get you anytime we want. Well, I think we've all known that for some time. When will they come for me? What excuse will they use? I don't know, Lee. They may wait until 2014, when Obamacare will make me a federal felon, because I don't have the money to buy the hugely expensive government health insurance, and I don't make enough for the IRS to seize the money in the form of fines. How about it, guys? You willing to give me another 2 years? That's a lot more Radio Free Northwest podcasts with all that music that some of you like. Okay, I think it's time to wash away some of last week's Orange Crush, musically speaking. Like I said last week, folks, I actually have a lot of sympathy for the Orangemen as people. And in point of fact, they have a very good position politically. There is no doubt that a Marxist enemy is trying to drive them out of their own land, and they have every right to defend themselves. But the simple fact is that the Fenians do sing better. Sorry, lads. This is Andy Irvin.
Michael Dwyer is my name. I'll not deny the same. In the mountains of West Wicklow I was born. I was in a fight of late with the man of 98 when we took an escorty by storm. When the rising was put down, we very quickly found that in our own homes we could no longer dwell. Ah, but many's a lonely cave some form of comfort gave, and the people of these mountains know us well. Well, the snow was falling fast, and the night was far advanced, when the three safe houses came in view. The weather was severe, but a guard was posted near, though the dangers on a night like this seemed few. But some sneaking little spy to his master he did fly, and may I live to even up the score. For it's when we awoke, to be sure it was no joke, to find 100 Highland soldiers at the door. Come out, you rebel band, cried the captain in command, you do not have a prayer, not a hope. Surrender to me now, and your lives, I vow, will be spared the bullet and the rope. Says Dwyer to his men, boys, here we are again, though I'm afraid this time it cannot be denied. It would take more than God's grace to defend this place from a regiment of soldiers outside. The house was set on fire with McAllister and Dwyer, expecting to perish in the flames. With the powder and the smoke, they were nearly overcome, crying a curse upon your bloody Highland games. From behind a stable wall, a well-aimed musket ball caused McAllister pain he could not hide. As his gun was blown away, he looked down with dismay at his arm hanging useless by his side. He says, Dwyer, I'm done, hand me up your gun, let's see what a spring you can make. As he opened the door, he gave one loud roar, I die for my country's sake. The volley rang out and Dwyer sprang forth, poor Sam received the fire. Oh, generous and brave McAllister gave up his life for Michael Dwyer. Well, before they could reload, he was halfway down the road with a kilted Scotsman snapping at his heels. The troopers held their fire till they saw what might transpire, and they watched as Dwyer tripped him in the field. Running like a mountain goat, no trousers, no coat, his bare feet were bleeding to be sure. As he crossed the black banks, he offered hearty thanks and got safely to a cave in Glenmalure. We lost 3 men that day, our captain got away, and the others surrendered on the spot. 3 of them, alas, were hanged in bolting glass, the others went before the firing squad. Dwyer fought the law 5 years, maybe more, till at last to Dublin he did go. And from there he set sail, bound for New South Wales, far from the county Wicklow.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to start out by saying that, you know, spring and summer, and even into the early fall, it's really a perfect time to migrate. You know, sometimes we'll become aware of people that are interested in migration, and then somehow or other we find out that they migrated, and sometimes that can bring up mixed feelings, because if you're not able to migrate yourself, sometimes there's almost a feeling as if the person died, but then you know that they're in a better place, and you have actual evidence that they've migrated. I mean, there are photos and postings on the internet and so forth, and you feel happy for them, and you feel kind of sad about being left behind, and I think that's going to happen more and more, and I hope that it'll encourage people to migrate. I know that for myself, I'm not able to migrate at this time for personal reasons. I ask myself if perhaps there's a metaphysical reason for this too, and the only thing that I can come up with is I must have some sort of karmic debt that hasn't been paid off, and that's why I'm not able to go to the homeland. I just know it's going to become increasingly hard for people, so I know it's going to be a motivation. I mean, I know it would be for me personally, so I'm hoping that eventually it will snowball. Now, the book that I have to talk about this week is something called The Bridge in the Abyss, and it's about the troubled friendship of Maxim Gorky and Vladimir Lenin. And this is one of the books that Harold sent me, and I found it very interesting. I'm just not exactly sure how it's really germane to the show. I mean, I'm sure there'll be people in the Northwest that are more interested in cultural preservation and some that just want to have, you know, total revolution, I suppose, and I don't know if it's two sides of Harold's character, like the writer and the revolutionary, or if it was just something he gave me for recreational reading, but it's by Bertram D. Wolfe. No, I found it enjoyable, interesting. I kept trying to find the link to the show, and I couldn't quite find it there, but since I spent a good deal of time reading it, I'm compelled to somewhat talk about it. So that's basically what's on my mind right now, and I guess the only other thing on my mind right now as pertains to the show is just how important it is to stay out of the legal system because of the way Zimmerman is, in a sense, being, I guess, scrutinized, even though he's not even white. So I suppose that's another thing on my mind. Other than that, you know, it's in many parts of the country, it's been very warm this summer, and I have to say I'm focusing on various hobbies of mine. I'm trying to find time to get to the beach. And that is one of the nice things, I think, about some parts of this country where it's actually warm enough to go to the beach. I don't know that it is in the homeland. I'd almost want to swim in a lake if I were in the homeland, if I could find a lake that was warm enough. So I hope you're enjoying your summer, but I also hope you're really thinking about migration because, you know, as more and more of your friends or people that you admire migrate, I mean, you're not going to want to be left alone. You're not going to be one of the people or wanting to be one of the people, for example, in the story Left Behind, where there's the rapture and everyone's left behind. You want to make it to the homeland in a timely fashion. So please consider that. Don't just stay at home if at all possible. You know, plan your migration. Try to look for jobs. There are all kinds of great sites to look for jobs on the internet, depending on what you're interested in. I mean, I know there are jobs just recently that I would like if I was able to move. I hope you'll be able to make migration soon. All right. Tonight, I'd like to make a few brief statements about the virtue of patience. You know, I know often on the show there are people, and even Harold himself, who will talk about some sort of urgency. And although there are some people who I have to admit are very heroic and that I admire because they're so brave, I have to say that when I look at the situation realistically, I think what we have to do right now is build community in the Northwest. I think we have to wait for the Soviet-style breakup to occur, or for some other crisis to come about that would literally facilitate or create, really, a Soviet-style breakup. Because without that, the government has, right now, a credible monopoly of armed force. And due to that fact, anyone who says that we are in some sort of situation where we have to act immediately, I would have to say that individual, although they may be brave, that individual, whoever they are really doing us no favors when they advocate such things. So I would say right now that we need to have a kind of a PLE attitude or kind of trying to be perhaps a bit like the Amish are in some sense. And by that, I just mean we need to focus on community building and staying within the law, because really that's what's going to be the best for us right now. So I really hope you take this into more than consideration. I hope that you will do what I'm advising. And in fact, I would actually pray for it. Okay, so I really hope that you listen to me, because, you know, sometimes I worry that I'm not the bravest person, and I admire people that are, I suppose, braver than me, but I would hope that I make up for that in a certain amount of wisdom. So I really pray that you'll listen to me. All right, so thank you for listening, and I hope you take my comments to heart.
A little over 2 years ago, attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law, an alleged hitman named Larry Fairfax, who was an FBI informer and who had been previously inserted into Steele's home by the Bureau, where, in addition to plotting perjury with his federal handlers, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of gold and silver that the Steeles were keeping on their property. The basis of Steele's conviction were fabricated audio files, discussions between himself and Fairfax, which appeared even to a layman to have been doctored. At Steele's trial, two international experts, who were prepared to testify that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender, was a raging alcoholic who was being sued by two of his own staff for various acts of misconduct, and Steele's second attorney, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. It's thought that that conviction may have played some part in preventing the crooked attorney himself from serving a prison sentence. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele looked like a zombie and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. The federal government of the United States did this to Edgar Steele in order to silence him. I intend to make sure that they fail. I've held off from doing this up until now to make absolutely sure that the trial is over and that Steele is going to die in prison, which is now the case. He's being held in the Victorville facility in California, which is well known throughout the federal system as a toilet where human beings are flushed away into eternity. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. It's time that Edgar Steele's voice was heard once again in the land, if for no other reason than because the FBI and the Obama regime do not want you to hear it. This piece is from 2009. Please bear in mind that Edgar Steele is not an actual white nationalist, or he wasn't. He's a conservative who's come to despise Jews, purely because he was victimized by them personally. I would imagine that 2 years in living hell, locked up with niggers and Mexicans, has rather changed his views on matters. But bear in mind that this was recorded before then. Hence some of the more wishy-washy comments about Obama. Lord, if only the poor bastard had known what was coming. Listening to this creeps me out. It's almost ghoulish. Anyway, here's Ed Steele. the man the FBI swore that they would silence forever.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. It's April 21, 2009, and today's Nickel Rant is entitled, Oh Bummer. Call me naive. Lots of people do, after all. Immediately after 9/11, I wanted to believe that it was Arabs who did the deed, and it took me a whole week to notice the overwhelming evidence to the contrary. And, once Barack Obama was elected, I called for us to come together in support of America's new president. I never imagined that anybody could be worse than George W. Bush. It begins to appear that I may have been wrong about that, too. Damn it all. You know, I want to like Obama. In fact, I still do, personally. After all, he's just so likable. Problem is, things are happening on his watch that continue to fracture America and, in fact, seem to be accelerating her plunge into the political, social, and economic abyss. Give him his due, however. Obama seems to have settled things down with countries like Iran and Venezuela. However, that merely has served to throw Israel into a frenzy. Ultimately, America seems to dance to the same tune that Israel already knows so well. Not that Israel controls America, mind you, but the same shadowy cartel that controls Israel does control America. Can you say Council on Foreign Relations, boys and girls? I knew you could. When, not if, Israel attacks Iran, the response will be guaranteed to draw in America as well. That, in turn, will draw in Russia and likely China. So even Obama's foreign relations rapprochements seem to be drawing us ever closer to World War III. Domestically, things aren't really much better. There's a superficial sheen of action on Obama's part, but the reality becomes graver every day. Sure, he released those government memos showing that torture was authorized at the highest levels of the Bush administration. But that has served to ignite nothing but criticism. Disclosure means that we have tipped our hand and can no longer employ those techniques because our enemies now will be prepared, say the critics. I've yet to hear anybody say that our forbidding torture actually is a good thing, though. I've yet to hear any real condemnation from officials or the media of the fact that America actually tortured people. That is just how far our country has come from the days of George Washington, who forbade injuring any prisoners because such conduct by his soldiers would, quote, bring shame, disgrace, and ruin to themselves and their country, close quote. And so it has. So it has. Deservedly so as well. After all, what have you or I done to bring an end to this shameful practice on behalf of America? And one guy was waterboarded nearly 200 times. 200! Think about it. You'd think that just a single experience of thinking he was going to drown would have been enough to elicit anything useful he might have had to say. 200 times shows that waterboarding was being used to mete out punishment of someone who never had been allowed a defense to any charges. I don't hear any criticism of that fact, folks. Makes you proud to be an American, doesn't it? And the bailouts. Oh, the bailouts. Talk about throwing gasoline on a fire. So we have a problem caused by the creation of money far in excess of the underlying production of goods and services designed to support it? And we hope to solve it by doing what exactly? Creating more money, of course. And not just a little bit, either. So much more new money that the word trillion now has gone into our lexicon, just as the word billion went in a few years ago after being an inconceivable concept. How long before we start talking about quadrillions of dollars, do you suppose? And just who do you suppose is in charge of deciding who gets what bailouts? Why, the same guys that got us into trouble in the first place, of course. That's why the banks and financial fat cat all are being made whole, and we're being sold down the river to finance their bailout. No, Mr. Obama is not making things better economically. In fact, history will show that he made them infinitely worse. People seem to be waking up to the fact that Obama, who never before managed anything so substantial as a fast food restaurant during his lifetime, just might be in over his head and relying upon the wrong people for advice. That's why his poll numbers are taking a nosedive during what still should be his presidency's honeymoon period. Even so, I still kind of like the guy. He just seems so damn naive is the problem. He's allowing others to dictate policy, both foreign and domestic, and they are the same old clique. All together now, Council on Foreign Relations. That's why the Obama administration actually looks a lot like the Bush administration, folks. Obama has announced his clear intent to legalize the illegal aliens now in America. And similarly, he shows a clear disregard for policing our southern border, just as did Bush. Obama has usurped the upcoming census and placed it under control of ACORN, the private association of hired guns proven to have committed so much election fraud during the past two elections. Guess what's about to happen to the reported demographics that determined electoral districts and representatives? Not that it'll make any difference, that is. In a very recent appellate court hearing, in a case entitled Jewel versus NSA, Obama's Justice Department lawyers actually argued for even greater immunity in conducting warrantless wiretapping of Americans than did Bush's. As a candidate for the presidency, Obama decried the use of what is known as the state secrets privilege by the Bush administration, and yet as president, Obama now argues for its unprecedented extension so as to provide unlimited immunity to the government for spying on all of us. The only reason that Congress is not moving forward with Obama's expressed desire to confiscate our guns is the fact that his election created such a boom in gun and ammunition sales that many stores post a picture of President Obama with the legend Salesman of the Year beneath it. And just try to go buy ammunition these days. The Department of Homeland Security, in a report that Obama has refused to disavow, has identified the vast majority of Americans as potential domestic terrorists. Returning military veterans are a danger because of their training, not to mention the fact that they become disaffected by being mistreated by the very government that sent them overseas to fight and die. Good enough to carry a gun and kill Arabs for Israel, but too dangerous to own a gun now that they've returned home. Opposed to illegal immigration? You're a potential terrorist, says the Department of Homeland Security. Are you opposed to gun confiscation? Yep. You're a potential terrorist, too. Are you unemployed? Can't get credit. Look out, because you could be a terrorist. Do you know anybody who expresses dissatisfaction with our federal government? The Department of Homeland Security would like you to report those individuals immediately to both it and the FBI, because they could be terrorists. Did you attend one of the thousands of TEA or Tea Parties held throughout America recently? The FBI and the Department of Homeland Security likely photographed you and recorded your license plate number because you're a prime suspect of being a domestic terrorist. What's more, agents of the FBI and Homeland Security followed orders in covertly gathering this data about attendees, particularly keeping their presence secret from state and local authorities. Seriously now. Does it sound as though Obama is changing anything for the better? Could things get any worse, do you suppose? In a word, yes. Hold on, because they sure aren't going to get better for a long, long time. I've just received word that this spring's record late freeze has destroyed approximately 75% of Oklahoma's 2009 wheat crop. This is a deadly serious fact, folks. one that has been repeated not only across all of America, but also throughout the Northern Hemisphere's entire grain belt. I'm sure that the total damage already has been estimated by government officials, but don't expect to hear the figures anytime soon. The implications are enormous. While I already had been predicting food riots for next year, the current wheat crop failures absolutely guarantee that they will take place. Get ready for martial law. I predict that we will see it enacted sometime next year, if not as early as this coming fall. Get ready for serious food shortages. The climate change responsible for one of the worst winters on record in America is continuing, and seems to support an inference that we are entering a mini ice age, such as that endured during mankind's Middle Ages. Get ready for rioting in the streets of our cities. Get ready for gun confiscation. And all you potential domestic terrorists, get ready to be arrested and held indefinitely without charges. With luck, we may avoid waterboarding, but that's about the best for which we all can hope. Martial law means no transportation, no internet, no cell phones, no freedom of any sort, complete lockdown, possibly in the company of a new 9/11 in the form of the disease pandemic that Dick Cheney so often has promised us. Already, mass media is so controlled that we likely will see no change in TV or the few newspapers that anybody bothers to read these days. You think things are bad right now? You ain't seen nothing yet. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name's Edgar J. Steele, and thanks for listening.
This is Steve Earle.
Then they turned on me. No judge, no jury, no hangman, no justice in Ontario. A 100 years or more have turned, and you always hear how much we miss. But a man lay dead on a portable bar, and the blood ran red on a hardwood. Men ran to the nearest door. Only one man knew what happened for sure. But a one and all were the outlaw's brand, and the big bikes rolled through the great Northland. Till we live on the edge of the law, you know, justice in Ontario. Hung in the air, no one spoke when the cops got there. Well, the local cops who made the call sent this Corporal Terry home. But they all sang a different tune. Corporal Hall walked in the room with his picture book and a list of names. One by one, the witnesses came, and they told him what he wanted to know: justice in Ontario. We'll be right back.
Okay, got another email, which I won't bother to read verbatim, because it basically asks another question to which I really don't know the answer, although it's one I get a lot. Harold, exactly how is this Northwest Republic thing going to come about? How's it all going to happen, Harold? Break out your crystal ball and tell us all in detail how it's all going to happen. Well, I wish I had a crystal ball, my friend, but I don't, any more than I have that pocket full of magic beans some of you seem to think I possess that I can just throw on the ground and make a finished product leap forth from the earth. Realistically, I simply don't know what more I can do with what I have to work with. That's like I've said before, I don't have followers, I have an audience. I am essentially in a form of show business. The whole history of my activity since the end of the old days in the 1980s has been everybody sitting around waiting for Harold to pull a rabbit out of a hat so they can applaud. I'm doing that right now with the videos and with Freedom's Sons, but no kidding, guys, at some point in time, I'm simply going to run out of rabbits, or run out of hats, or both. Now, you want to know when the revolution is going to start? You tell me. You guys are the one that's going to have to do it. At the rate we're going, by the time you people do get your asses in gear, if ever, I'm probably going to be gone from the scene in one way or another, either dead or medically incapacitated or in prison. But to try and answer the question, okay, the breakup of the United States, which will give us and others as well our window of opportunity, will obviously happen one of two ways. Either it will happen slow or it'll happen fast. Now, I used to think that all we had to look forward to was one long, slow crumbling away until in 50 years' time we resembled Brazil at best. I never was one of the balloon-gonna-go-up crowd, but now I'm not so sure. I am very disturbed by the fact that no one seems to get what is going to happen when the Jews attack Iran and the Western world loses one-third of its imported raw petroleum. Now, let's put it this way. If the FBI does finally decide to come and arrest me for square dancing in a roundhouse or whatever ridiculous charge they can fabricate on their computers, they're going to have to take me away in a horse-drawn paddy wagon from the 19th century they pulled out of some museum. But suppose I'm right and it does happen fast like that. Guys, what can I tell you? I repeat, I'm just a show business personality. I'm not a leader of anything. Leaders have followers who actually do what the leader says. I have an audience that turns me on once a week, listens to this show, and then tunes in again next week. Now, you guys really, really need to give up this idea some of you seem to have that I am some kind of man on a white horse who is going to lead the charge. You can't lead when nobody's following you. I think that's what some of you think I'm going to do one day, like Teddy in the play in the movie Arsenic and Old Lace. You think I'm going to blow a bugle and draw my sword and go running up the stairs yelling, "Charge!" However it happens, guys, that ain't going to be it. Now, the way things work out in real life and actual practice is usually something like this. People come into our circle, they hang around with us on the internet for a bit, waiting for great things magically to appear for their entertainment and their edification. And when this doesn't happen after a certain length of time, however long or short their attention span is, they wander away in search of fresh sensation and stimulation for their jaded mental and emotional palates. In other words, most of the people who get into the NF on the internet are Americans. They're capable of being intensely interested and enthusiastic about anything for 15 minutes. They can't help the way they are, but until I can locate that first 1,000 people I keep mentioning, there ain't no revolution coming out of the Northwest Front, no matter how much you like my novels and podcasts and videos. Now, most people in my audience, for I say again, that's what it is, are in essence waiting for me to, quote-unquote, do something. I've never been quite sure what. I guess people just assume that I have some kind of magic beans in my pocket and I can just drop them on the ground and cause a revolution to leap out of the earth like Jack's beanstalk. Every now and then I do get a vague glimpse of what this mysterious something I'm supposed to do is. I know I've gone over this before, but we need to get a handle on this, folks, because it's a problem. And it's holding us back. Now, apparently this something that I'm supposed to be doing in order to be a leader involves me standing in front of a big crowd making some kind of impassioned speech or maybe on live national television, which I'd be quite willing to do, by the way, if anybody can ever come up with a crowd willing to listen to me or find some way to get the media to point the TV cameras at me without us making a fool of ourselves and without anybody getting killed or going to prison. Now, I'm working on that, but so far I haven't found the secret formula yet. I think some people still, in the back of their minds, envision me wearing a costume of some kind while I'm making this impassioned speech to the crowd or on TV, whatever. Possibly the uniform of a Napoleonic dragoon or something, and that ain't going to happen either. Anyway, as nearly as I can determine, once this impassioned speech of mine is concluded, everybody will run around hollering and waving their arms in the air for a bit, and then everything will be cool, and we'll have a white paradise here in the Northwest, and we can pay for everyone to move here and provide moving vans and crews so nobody will have to do any work or heavy lifting, and give everybody in our audience jobs and houses, and for all I know, a leprechaun and a pot of gold. I'm not joking, people. Most of you out there who even pretend to believe that revolution is possible seem to have no more advanced notion or vision as to how the Republic is supposed to come about than what I've just said. Yeah, I know everybody's read the Northwest novels, but surely Harold doesn't expect anybody to do anything like that, right? I mean, that would be foolish and dangerous. The big bad policeman might hurt us. Okay, I get it, guys. I know you're Americans, and you have been taught all your lives to avoid effort, to flee from it. Now, you remember the old American motto, don't work hard, work smart? Which is another way of saying, find some way to get someone else to do all the heavy lifting and take all the risk while you get the credit and the gravy. Kind of a basic principle of capitalism there. When you guys listen to the show, and then sit back and watch and wait to see what rabbits Harold will pull out of his hat, and whether or not Harold will be able to talk some guys into coming Northwest and doing all the heavy lifting for you. In your own minds, you're doing nothing wrong. I get that. You're just being Americans. You're working smart, not hard. You're avoiding risk and effort. You understand that trying is the first step to failing, and so you're waiting for someone else to cross the bridge first to see if it's safe. Okay, fine. Like I say, I get it. I understand. God knows, after 10 years of this, since I came home myself, I ought to. But back to the question as to how the Republic will happen. If it happens fast, through a Jewish attack on Iran or otherwise, then in view of the fact that we've basically wasted the past 10 years and we have nothing ready here in the Northwest, we'll just have to see how it plays out. I'm not going to give up trying to get you people to come home, but frankly, it looks like I'm out of time and events may be about to intervene. Of course, it could still happen slow. Now, I've noticed some signs in the world media that some of the people who hold actual power around the globe are just as worried and appalled as I am about what's going to happen when Benjamin Netanyahu launches his bombers in October, if only because they themselves are going to lose immense amounts of money. I believe from hints in the media that there are moves being made behind the scenes to stop Israel and bring the world to a de facto acceptance of a nuclear Iran, which is in fact the only sensible solution. These behind-the-scenes moves might succeed, and I hope they do. Unlike some of our own yahoos, I really don't want to see everything go to complete hell in a handcart. I'm a little too old for that. So suppose somebody is able to talk Benjamin Netanyahu down from the ledge, and the present long, slow decay continues. What happens then? Well, it could be all kinds of things. It could be that the American central state simply withers away from its own incompetence and from a lack of funds, or at least a lack of funds that will actually buy anything. The Federal Reserve can go berserk, printing up monopoly money all they want, and the only thing that will happen is you'll be paying $15,000 for a Big Mac and $20,000 per gallon for gasoline. Now, that won't get the frozen burgers to the Mickey D's or the gasoline to the pump. Let's imagine a scenario a few years from now, okay? Now, let's say you're a typical state or federal official here in the Pacific Northwest, a cop or a police chief, an FBI agent or a U.S. marshal, a state or federal judge who's been handing out the decades of prison time like it was popcorn, a district or U.S. attorney, a prison guard, a lawyer, a wealthy man who has made his fortune off the backs of white working people in some way or other, a left-wing college professor, a media personality here in the Northwest, a Jew of any kind. Now, all your life, you've gotten away with it. Why? Not because you're right or because you have justice and morality on your side, far from it, but because you have armed men who will come at your beck and call and make other people do your bidding. Cops and FBI agents and whatnot are central to this whole problem because they are the muscle men, the gunmen who keep Obama and the Democrats in power. They make it impossible for the people actually to do anything about those 535 yay-saying leeches in Congress. It's their guns and their institutional violence that forces white people to obey the will of thieves and lunatics and predators. At least until such time as we find the collective will to resist. So, you're somebody who's done well off the system because you can call on the muscle men to make others obey. But all of a sudden, or maybe just gradually, things start to change. And one morning you wake up and you realize that you're living in a different world. The mayor of Seattle or Portland or Spokane can no longer get on the horn to the White House if things get really hairy and call for the 82nd Airborne and the 3rd Marine Division to back him up. Those units are sitting on fire bases in Iran, desperately trying to keep the Straits of Hormuz open and the oil flowing. The FBI agent looking out the window of his corner office won't let on, but he knows that the day when the Bureau could flood the Northwest with 800 agents like they did when the order broke bad back in the 1980s, those days are long over. There just isn't the budget or the manpower for it anymore. FBI offices all over the country are straining at the seams trying to deal with Iran-related bullshit or simply drowning in paperwork and affirmative action-related incompetence. The local police chief, in turn, knows that if he runs into serious trouble, the amount of backup he can call on is now severely limited. Not even the Oregon or Idaho or Washington National Guard. They've all been mobilized for active duty, and all the weekend warriors aren't so weekend anymore. Now they're sitting on some mountainside in Afghanistan, or in some latrine in Yemen. In other words, one morning, everyone who holds power in this society is going to wake up and realize that they are seeing the calm before the storm. They've lost their ultimate resource, the threat of overwhelming armed violence and irresistible physical force. They can't pick up the phone and unleash the Red Terror anymore. Their backup is either gone completely, or by now so attenuated that even the backup itself could be taken out by men with a few hairs on their testicles. They may or may not still have those silly drones, but those don't work half the time due to bad intelligence, and in any case, they're not really effective except as a psychological weapon, kind of like the Zeppelins in World War I. Anyway, the point I'm trying to get at is that one morning, it's just going to be us and them. Whatever is in each police station and FBI office by way of men and weapons and body armor, and that can be pretty formidable, but that's it. Once that's gone, defeated or defected or neutralized through not being paid, then that's all she wrote. No more terrified politicians picking up the phone and bringing in overwhelming and irresistible force. We're all on our own now, one-on-one. And on that same morning, the white people of the Northwest wake up to the same knowledge. I don't know how it'll happen, some kind of osmosis, but all of a sudden, The people of this land are going to know that their oppressors are no longer all-powerful. Who's going to protect all those nigger dope dealers now? Who's going to protect all those illegal brown immigrants who stole every entry-level job in town and drove the price of rental housing through the roof so poor white people can't survive anymore? Who's going to defend those butt-fucking faggots who live in million-dollar condos and drive Priuses with Obama stickers on them now? Whatever's in those police stations and FBI offices and a few other places, maybe the odd National Guard armory and maybe the small remaining skeleton staff at McCord Lewis, anyway, that's it. That's all that's standing between us and freedom. And those bastards know that we know. And they're sweating. Yeah, it might happen like that.
What goes around comes around. Feel it breathing down here on you. You made that bed you're laying on. Deeds that you have done now you can't undo. You got bones in your closet. You got ghosts in your town. Ain't no doubt, yeah, they're gonna come out. They're waiting for the sun to go down. You can't hide from your demons. Feel them all lurking around. You're running scared cause you know they're out there. They're waiting for the sun to go down.
If nothing in the present inspires us to valor and struggle and sacrifice, then maybe something in our past can. In July of 1936, the people of Spain revolted against their tyrannical and murderous communist government. The uprising was led by General Francisco Franco and had the support of most, although not all, of the Spanish military, the Catholic Church, the middle classes, and a very large section of normal working class people as well. The popular left-wing myth that the Spanish Civil War was nothing more than a military coup is unfounded. The fact that Franco was able to establish a stable and relatively prosperous society that lasted for over 40 years belies this. When it became apparent that the initial rising in Madrid had failed, the nationalist supporters in Toledo, which is 40 miles to the southwest of the capital, declared for Franco and occupied the military academy in the ancient Alcazar fortress. The garrison was mainly drawn from the local Guardia Civil and Falange, but also included a handful of teenage military cadets, most were on their summer holidays, a large number of women and children, as well as civilians, and a number of nuns who had fled to the fort for safety from the marauding communist militia and the asaltos, or assault guards, who were the Spanish Republic's paramilitary goon squads. The motley crew of resistance fighters was commanded by the commandant of the academy, Colonel José Moscardo. At that time, Toledo was a nationalist island surrounded by Republican-held territory, and it was psychologically as well as strategically vital that the Red Government in Madrid recover the symbolic fortress as soon as possible. They dispatched a large force of militia, asaltos, army troops who remained loyal to the government, international brigades, and Soviet quote-unquote advisors, as well as the dreaded POUM anarchist paramilitary gangs to capture the Alcazar. Within days, the ancient castle was surrounded by hastily built barricades and besieged with sniper and machine gun fire. One of the most famous incidents of Spanish heroism during the war took place on July the 23rd, 1936. The communist commander reached Moscardo by telephone within the Alcazar, and the colonel was informed that the communist forces had arrested his 16-year-old son, Luis, a cadet at the academy under his father's command. And unless Moscardo surrendered immediately, Luis would be executed. To prove that they had his son, he was put on the phone to speak to his father. The boy spoke up proudly. "Father, if you surrender your command to the enemies of Spain in order to save my life, I shall disown you and never more acknowledge you as my blood." His father replied, "Die like a Spaniard, my son." The enraged communists then shot Luis in the head. A second Moscardo son was later captured and executed in Madrid. In the Alcazar today, the telephone still remains on display. Repeated assaults against the castle walls failed and resulted in heavy government casualties. The Reds had brought artillery with them, but only light field guns, which could be shielded against through the extensive use of sandbagging on the ramparts, and the poorly trained Republican militia were such bad cannon shots that they often missed the huge castle completely, and their shells fell on the hapless city. Then they ran out of shells entirely, and the incompetent, bickering Republican staff in Madrid were unable to supply any more. Crude attempts at aerial bombing also failed. For the next 2 months, the defenders held out against the Republican units besieging them. Their only source of water was a cistern in the main courtyard. Fortunately, they were able to fill it up because it took the Reds some time to figure out how to shut off the water mains. After that, the hundreds of people in the fortress, many of them non-combatants, had to rely on rainwater caught in sheets and tarps. In August, they ran low on food and had to rely on nightly stealth foraging expeditions over the walls to raid a grocery warehouse the Nationalists knew about in town, but which the Reds had somehow overlooked. They also had to crawl down and scavenge ammunition by ambushing Republican sentry posts or looting the corpses of those killed in the day's fighting. Many local residents of Toledo who had remained behind in the city risked their lives to supply Moscardo and his men with food, ammunition, and intelligence on the enemy's activities, and many were summarily tortured and executed because they were suspected, rightly or wrongly, of helping the Alcazar's defenders or being in contact with them. In mid-September, the Reds brought in a sapper unit of anarchist Asturian miners who tunneled beneath the walls and planted a large explosive device, which they detonated in a massive blast, bringing down a section of the wall. Now the Reds could gain partial entry into the Alcazar, and the fighting slowly progressed from building to building, floor to floor, room to room. One upstairs classroom became known as the Chamber of Death. In the meantime, General Franco was receiving regular reconnaissance reports from his Air Corps on the situation, and he realized that the Alcazar couldn't hold out much longer. His army was marching on Madrid in four columns, hence General Molina's famous remark about his fifth column inside the city. Franco faced a choice. He could divert one of the columns to relieve the Alcazar and risk not having enough troops to capture the capital, or else he could ignore the sideshow in Toledo and concentrate on his main strategic objective. Franco spent a whole night in thought and prayer, and in the morning he made his decision. He said, "This is a matter of the honor of the Spanish army. We cannot leave Moscardo and his heroes to their fate, as well as the women and children." He ordered General Jose Varela to alter his line of march and storm Toledo. On September the 27th, 1936, Nationalist troops from the Army of Africa entered the city. The Reds fled back to Madrid without much of a fight. The raising of the siege of the Alcazar did much to enhance General Franco's reputation. But the diversion of Varela's troops from the advance on Madrid gave the capital's defenders further time to prepare their defenses, and time for Soviet supplies and weapons to arrive. Franco has been criticized by military historians for his decision, which may well have prolonged the Civil War. But for the rest of his life, he always maintained that he had been right to put honor before expediency. Colonel Moscardo was promoted to the rank of general. He fought well throughout the rest of the war, and later led the Spanish Blue Division of Volunteers on the Eastern Front during World War II. The main Spanish command post on the Russian front was always referred to as the Alcazar. These are the men that we once were. We can be those men again if we will only look within ourselves and remember. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.